Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Baby, I'll give it to you.
That looks really good.
Yes, it does. It's dead on.
Okay, keep the chatter down in this room.
Are you ready to begin?
Yes, I'm all set, yeah.
What a sight when the ground cameras at Stardust. We're flying at twice the thrust of the Saturn V heading to space.
Welcome to Space Boffins, hopefully without any rapid, unscheduled disassembly. I'm Richard Hollingham.
And I'm Sue Nelson. I like what you did there. This time we're in conversation with NASA's new head of science, Dr. Nicola Fox, who grew up in the UK, just a few miles from where we're recording this podcast, in Leafy, and it is Leafy, Hertfordshire. And we'll chat about some of the 100 or so missions that Nicola is responsible for in just a moment. Plus, we'll meet one of the European Space Agency's most experienced astronauts, as well as one of ESA's new recruits, who's just started training and could end up on the moon.
It's still a long way. I need to start my training. I need to be assigned to an ISS mission before even being on the queue to the missions to Mars. To the moon.
Hold on there.
Sorry. But yes, of course, it will be a dream come true to have this opportunity.
That's Pablo. I love him already.
He's great. He's so nice.
Sounded lovely. Well, back in the December podcast, we spoke to NASA's outgoing head of science and good friend of the Space Boffins podcast, Thomas Zurbuchen. Thomas was responsible for overseeing the turnaround of the James Webb Space Telescope through to a successful launch and now those incredible images, among other things.
Oh,
in
yes,
we couldn't list them so far. No, exactly.
But if you want to hear more, do listen back to that podcast because he's absolutely brilliant as always. Well, naturally, we thought it would be nice to meet his successor, particularly as she's from Hitchin, a small town just down the road from Space Boffins HQ. Well, Dr. Nicola Fox completed her PhD in space and atmospheric physics at Imperial College London, but it was a chance meeting that led her to NASA. Nicola, welcome to the Space Boffins podcast. We're absolutely delighted that you've got your new post and also that there's this amazing career route from Hertfordshire to Houston, effectively. Was this always part of your grand master plan?
No, I don't think I ever had a grand master plan, actually. I think, you take your journey one step at a time, and that's kind of what I did. You know, I never realized, honestly, that I could work for NASA. So when I was a child, you think it's great. You want to be an astronaut. You want to, study all these things. You think space is fascinating. But the idea of actually working for NASA, honestly, never occurred to me until right before I moved. I was at a conference in Alaska when I was doing my PhD, and I was talking about my work, and a scientist just literally said, "Would you be interested in applying for a postdoc at NASA?" And so I didn't know that was a possibility.
Were you aware at the time that Hertfordshire has Airbus, which is now really well known for its spacecraft for various missions, including those that go to Mars?
Yes, actually. We used to be British Aerospace back in the day. and then I think it became Astrium and then now Airbus. And so, yes, actually, one of the missions we have in the heliophysics division at NASA is Solar Orbiter, which is a partnership with ESA. And of course, the spacecraft was actually built in Stevenage, just a few miles away from where my parents live. And actually, my parents once went on a tour of the factory. They were so interested in it and wanted to learn more about it. So, we're very familiar with that.
So, Hertfordshire taking over, really, in space. It is a really a master plan to take over NASA and ESA.
One mission at a time.
Okay. And you joined NASA from Johns Hopkins University. You mentioned heliophysics there because you were involved with the Solar Parker probe.
Yes, coolest, hottest mission under the sun is my hashtag for that. But yes, I worked for many, many, many years on Parker Solar Probe at the Applied Physics Lab, which is part of Johns Hopkins University. And I was lucky enough to be the project scientist, so the lead scientist for that mission. And it was amazing. Just, I love the, I'm kind of what we call an A to D junkie. So there are five phases of a mission, A through E. And E is when it's actually launched and taking the science. But probably B through D is where you're really doing the concentrated mission design and building the spacecraft, and then launch comes at the end of phase D. And so I really love that part. That's the where you're working with the engineers and you're sort of really, the mission is taking shape and you're seeing it before your eyes actually becoming a real mission. I did that with Parker Solar Probe, and then 3 weeks after it launched, I went down to NASA headquarters to run the heliophysics division.
And they're really delivering, aren't they, those missions, Parker Solar Probe and, I mean, Solar Orbiter. It's starting to send back these incredible pictures of the sun and delivering results and getting closer and closer all the time as its orbit changes.
Yes, Parker Solar Probe, just about a year and a half away from being in the final configuration when they're below 4 million miles from the sun's surface, which is super close. And Solar Orbiter, golly, those images. I saw one, I was at a conference last year, and they had some of their very detailed images. And it kind of started with a full disk image and then honed in on this really amazingly detailed image. I mean, it almost looked like driving down a sort of leafy lane in England at sunset, you know, when everything's sort of gold and orange. And I literally was tearing up at thinking, you know, I can't believe we're looking at a star in this much detail. It was just amazing. So yes, and having the partnership as well, having Parker Solar Probe doing the sort of in situ measurements while Solar Orbiter is taking these phenomenal images is just a dream come true for solar scientists. I mean, to have the two missions together, and even right now, Solar Orbiter just sort of lifting out of the ecliptic plane and starting to be able to look down on the poles, or pretty soon they'll be able to look down on the northern pole of the sun. But while they're still in the same plane, we've been doing really great collaborative science with both sets of in situ instruments. So the ones that we actually, you know, they're taking the measurements at the spacecraft bus. So very complementary sets and great science to do there.
Why is that mission, or why are those missions so important? And can you get that across? Because obviously there's the sexy stuff like Moon and Mars and Jupiter, which we'll come on to. But I mean, you know, obviously it's our nearest star, but there's more to it than that, isn't it?
Well, yes, but it is our nearest star, which I think is fascinating. I mean, the fact that we have a star in our backyard, and even though it is very difficult to go and study the sun up close, it took 60 years to develop the technology to actually be able to do that. But it is relatively easy to get to our star. It is extremely difficult to get to another star. So we can study our star up close, and we often say it's an average star, which makes it sound really boring. But the reason that it's an average star, the thing that makes it so exciting, is it's an average star that actually sustains life. And so we live here on the planet. We live in this sort of Goldilocks region where we're not too hot, we're not too cold, we're not too close, we're not too far away. We're just in this perfect region where life can be sustained. And so our star is a very extraordinary, ordinary star. It's one that is sustaining life. And so by understanding our star and our planet's relationship with it, we can then go on to look for other possible habitable zones in other galaxies. And that for me is just amazing.
I totally agree with you about that phrase, average star. I loathe it. And it really, really irritates me. Now, you're going to be directing the science for about 100 missions, I read, as part of your job. How are you going to prioritize those missions, you know, least of all the logistics of it in terms of science? And will you suddenly find that the ones relating to the sun are always at the top of your pile?
No, absolutely not. I love all my children equally. And obviously, I mean, Parker Solar Probe is going to be close to my heart because I was the lead scientist on it. I had a relationship with, you know, very, very sort of close mentored relationship with Eugene Parker. And he was there at the launch, and I got to be the first one to show him all the data when the data came down. And I gave his laureate lecture. Sadly, he passed away before he was able to do his Crawford Prize. So that one's always got a special place in my heart. I mean, that's never going to change. We have so many exciting missions coming up. One that I'm particularly excited about right now is actually coming back to Earth, and that's the OSIRIS-REx mission, and it's returning samples. They'll arrive September 24th of this year, and we'll be able to actually start studying an asteroid. And this asteroid is really interesting because it's a very old asteroid. It's a carbaceous asteroid. It's full of carbon, and it was around at the time that our solar system was forming. And so we think it's got sort of the precursors of planet formation and maybe what it takes to sustain water. And also, it's an asteroid that in, I think it's the next century, could be on a collision course with, or certainly have a very close call with our planet. And so learning what that asteroid is made of means that we can actually think about a future, obviously way in the future, but a future impactor mission like the DART mission that last year knocked the dual asteroid system Dimorphos off, you know, changed its orbital period and actually changed its trajectory. That's one mission, returning samples, and we're going to learn all that from one mission. Also later this year we have the Psyche mission that is also going to an asteroid, but this one's going to a heavy metal asteroid. So it's going to be looking at the things that if in the future we actually wanted to travel outside our solar system, we would have to look for sustained things that we could sustain our journey, we'd be looking for heavy metals and things that are on asteroids. So there's two missions I'm excited about, and they're both asteroid missions and nothing to do with the sun.
Just talk us through the return to Earth, because I mean, that's not, you make it sound quite casual, it's just going to return to Earth, but there's quite a lot to that.
There is actually, there's a lot to sample return in general, which will bring me to a Martian mission in a minute. But yes, I mean, the mission design is exquisite, and you learn a total appreciation for, if you work with some of these engineers, by the way, they'll say, oh, it's just orbital dynamics. You're like, yeah, that's Greek to me. So it's like an art form that these folks do that do the mission design and figure out when you need to fire the thrusters, if you're flying by a planetary object and using it for a gravity assist. I mean, this is all very, very carefully planned before the mission launches. And so OSIRIS-REx flew out to the asteroid Bennu and then basically had to do a touch sample, collect the samples, bring it back, close up the sample container, and then propel that back to Earth. So it is extremely precise, sort of precision science and engineering, but it gives us doing this kind of mission gives us some sort of experience as we get ready to go to Mars and return the samples from there. So if you have been paying attention to our Perseverance rover that has been roving around on Mars, you can log in and see where Percy is on any particular day, and also how our helicopter is flying as well. It's just completed 50 flights of, that was a tech demo, so Ingenuity, lovingly called Ginny for short. And so you can follow kind of the progress there. And I always feel like when I look at those images, it's like getting a postcard, you know. So I've been asked a couple of times, if you could travel to a planet, which one would you go to? And I keep saying it would be Mars, because I feel like I know so much about it. It's like you've watched a documentary on TV and you've seen the travel place, you know, a destination that's really exotic. And you think, golly, I really want to go to Bora Bora, you know, because you've seen these things. And then you see all these postcards from Mars and you think, I want to go see that. Anyway, so while Percy has been roving around, it's an amazing, amazing piece of technology, but it has a sample arm, comes down, collects samples, and has been collecting them in very different locations around this particular area of Mars. So getting different soils and rocks and, you know, different types of samples. And they've laid down 10 of these sample tubes on the Martian surface, which is our first cache. Percy is continuing to go off and collect more samples. And then we are in the very, very early stages of designing a sample return mission, which is extremely complicated. So you have to, you know, send, there's going to be an orbiting piece of it that will just orbit around Mars. There'll be a lander piece that comes down, and then just imagine the technology of having to program something to reach out and pick up a sample tube, put it into a container, seal the container, launch the container off the surface of Mars. We've never launched anything off another planet. Rendezvous with the orbiting spacecraft, and then have that the sample return capsule will then be expelled and sent back to Earth. So it's kind of, even I in my position am amazed about how complicated this mission is. I had a 5-hour briefing on this mission last week, and it was not boring. It was supposed to be 4 hours. I extended it by an hour because it was so interesting, and that there's still more to learn just about the exquisite engineering that it will take to do that. So there you are, all those missions. I haven't mentioned the sun once.
And you can tell how excited you are about Percy and Mars.
Oh yeah.
What about Artemis? Because obviously that's something that loads of people are talking about at the moment, very interested in, not least because the crew for Artemis 2 have been announced. Is the science that's going to be done on these missions, is that sort of slightly lower down the priority scale?
No, it's an amazing, I mean, honestly, we take advantage of any way to do science. And so working with our exploration colleagues, and it really is science for exploration, exploration for science, and designing the science that we will do either on the missions that will precede the astronauts getting there. We have a commercial lunar partnership. It's called Eclipse Program for Commercial Lunar Payload Services. And so we have some commercial landers, and they're carrying NASA science instruments that will land ahead of any crew. We have rovers going up. We have actually a hopper that's going to hop around on the surface of the moon, which is really cool. And then we have the gateway, the lunar gateway, which is basically the sort of support habitat for the crew. We've put some science instruments on there. They're actually heliophysics instruments. They're going to be studying space weather because the moon is a great place to study space weather because it actually orbits around the Earth. And so sometimes you're in the pristine solar wind, and sometimes you're in that magnetotail, that sort of protective magnetic bubble behind the planet. And so we can study all kinds of space weather from there. And provide space weather forecasts for the crew. But really designing what the astronauts are going to do while they're up there is incredible. Because if you think, it's really hard to bring samples back. Now, that samples back on the planet are worth more than you can believe. I actually was just at Johnson Space Center. I went out for the crew announcement, and I got to go to the Apollo lab where they have all of the samples from the Apollo missions. Oh, and they are still using them. They are still giving us new science 50 years after the last sample was taken. So we recently grew little plants or little I can't remember exactly what they were, but we grew them in the lunar regolith. So, you know, all these things you can do with samples. But if you have experiments that the astronauts can do on the surface of the moon, you don't even have to bring the samples back. So there's a lot of science that we actually want them to do while they're up on the planet. Also, all the new tools that they'll be taking up with them to enable easily take samples, seal them, vacuum seal them, make sure that they're in pristine when they get back to Earth. But it's just amazing. And then, you know, sneakily thinking about, okay, once we've got a sustained presence on the moon, it's on to Mars. And so what are our astronauts going to do when they get to Mars? So it's a fabulous time to be in the agency and to be working in and around NASA, partnering, as I said, with our commercial partners, partnering with international agencies, a close partnership with ESA, in fact, on the Mars sample return mission. They are building the orbiter. I actually think it might even be, it's definitely Airbus. It might even be Stevenage that's building it. I'll have to be able to check on that. I think yes. It is. And so back to Hertfordshire we go. And we're putting the sample return capsule will be on that ESA module where NASA will build that. And then ESA is providing hardware for the lander. So it's a really, really tightly coupled partnership, allowing us to do all this great exploration as one big, happy family.
Sounds it.
Where do you stand then on the humans versus robots? Or would you prefer humans to do it because they can do so much more than the robots?
It is a So it's a fabulous partnership between the two. I mean, you can send robotic missions where you can't send people, clearly. But people can make, you know, you have to pre-program the robotic missions. Some do have, you have the ability to change, certainly with Perseverance, because you can see what it's doing. You can actually sort of program more in real time. But astronauts can do skills that it's very hard to get robots to do. So it is a perfect world where we have both of them. You know, you have spacecraft orbiting around Mars, sampling the atmosphere around Mars, seeing how the solar wind is impacting Mars, communications relays sending back all the data from the surface of Mars, those rovers going all over the place, helicopters flying now, but still a very big role for humans as well.
Now, we interviewed your predecessor a few times, actually, on the Space Boffins podcast, Thomas Zabirkin. He had a major challenge when he took on the role, and that was sorting out the James Webb Space Telescope and getting it working, and what a success that is proving to be. What's your biggest challenge, or is everything in pretty good state with a pretty good plan, or are there things that worry you?
Would you on your top of your to-do list with a big star on, basically?
Well, so first of all, thank you, Thomas, for launching James Webb before you left. That was great. But Mars sample return is an extremely high priority. You know, it's an agency priority, finding the way to make sure we can do that mission, bring those samples back. Many, many reasons we want to do that. Also, it is really the precursor to sending crew to Mars, because when you have to be able to land safely and take off safely from the planet. And so doing that with the samples is definitely a risk reduction for sending human missions. So that is a very high agency priority to do that. But also our Earth System Observatory, so protecting our planet, doing those sort of continuity measurements, making sure we always have the measurements that you need to be able to follow storms, follow tornadoes, follow hurricanes, follow big storms that are going to happen. Monitoring wildfires, looking at how pollution changes over the day, looking at sea level, looking at the ice sheets, all those things. We have an Earth System Observatory, and the important thing is that we need to fly many missions at the same time to really characterize the planet. And so that's a big challenge, getting missions, high quality missions. You know, we think of our Earth science as NASA's really on the cutting edge. You know, we fly the first of a kind technology. We do the first of a kind science. We have these amazing high fidelity models that we produce, but then we want to actually hand them over to people to use them in an operational way. So it's I think of us kind of as the tip of the spear. You know, we do the same with space weather. We can fly the first of a kind measurements. We can look at the ones that really make the difference to your ability to predict things. And so that's what we want to do. So really getting all those Earth science missions, getting our arms around those, getting those well on their way and launched, and then making Mars sample return, a reality. So they're my two highest priorities.
It's lovely the fact that, we've gone from a Swiss-born science director to a British-born woman in the post. You'll be the first woman, the first Brit in this post. We know that Thomas, as often the case with NASA, is extremely good on the outreach and also prioritised encouraging diversity. How are you going to build upon that aspect of your job?
I'll just say I'm actually the second woman to have the post.
Oh, beg
Mary
your pardon.
Cleave. No, fine. The fabulous Mary Cleave was an astronaut, and she held it, I'm not sure, maybe 15 years ago, maybe more than that, actually.
I was from a newspaper article. I read that. So naughty, naughty article that they said you're the first woman.
No, that's fine. I am the first Brit. That is true.
That's not necessarily diversity, though, is it? That's probably not a NASA target. How many Brits can we get?
Absolutely.
It would be from our point
of view.
Yes,
it would, yeah.
Absolutely. It's different perspectives, different backgrounds. And so that really actually is, embracing diversity in every sense of the word and inclusion. I mean, without inclusion, you'll never really have diversity. And diverse teams are always the strongest. If you have people that think alike, look alike, from the same background, you'll get the same. That's all you ever get is the same. And so bringing in new ways of thinking, new perspectives, new backgrounds into mission teams is always really important. But really fostering an environment where everybody feels included and feels that they can take part. And so one of my goals really is lowering the boundaries to space and to science in general, so that more people realize that everyone really is a scientist. Every time you ask why, you're a scientist. If you're curious about anything, that's some kind of science. That's a scientific method. And so making an environment where people really feel that whatever they're interested in, whatever their passions are, it's linked to science. It's linked to space most of the time. We have a initiative called the Heliophysics Big Year. So I'm just going to, okay, so here's sun for a moment. and that's because we're about to kick it off in October. There are two solar eclipses that will be visible from the US. One in October of this year, it's an annular solar eclipse. That's when you get like a ring of fire around the sun. And then in April of next year, we get a total solar eclipse. And so we're building this sort of focused campaign around certain solar and heliophysics activities. So aurora, we're going to be coming up to solar maximum when the sun is the most active. Parker Solar Probe, just about a year and a half away from their closest close approach. And so building on this idea of putting all these events together and talking about science in general and trying to appeal to even subcultures. So if you're interested in cooking, if you boil pasta, you see the convection that goes up. That's what happens on the sun. You know, we're sort of playing with the idea of solar flares and people who are into fashion. And if you have, 27 pieces of flare, or you wear your bell-bottom pants or whatever it is, there's so much in fashion that links to space, and there's so much in everything you do, music, art, there's so much that links to space. And so we're trying to use this to just really encourage more people to just think, I can get involved. There's a big emphasis on citizen science. We've got a tremendous group of citizen scientists that use all of our NASA data, and they use it and they do great science with it. You don't need a PhD. You just need to be curious, and you just need to be driven to do more. So that's kind of that's my passion, to get people talking about science. Science isn't scary. You do not have to be a super duper smart, boffin to be able to do science. Everybody does science all the time.
Nice use of the word boffin. Thank you. just have a quick shout out before a question from Sue for marmalade, because I make marmalade every year and I take pictures of it. And when it's boiling away, it looks exactly like those videos that Easter have sent, like the of the sun.
You've probably set off a conspiracy theory now. I just wondered, Nicola, that what your inspiration was, because for people of a certain age, they always cite the moon landings, but you were born the year of the moon landings, so unless you were a child prodigy, I assume you have no memory of it at the time. So what was it that just gave you that spark to look up into the sky and wonder?
So I was 9 months old, or 8 or 9 months old, when Neil Armstrong landed on the moon. And my dad picked me out of my cot and took me and propped me up in front of the TV and gave me a running commentary. So he says that is why I'm interested, because clearly, clearly I picked up all that information at that early age.
Taking the credit, yes.
But he was always fascinated with space, and he would always, look up at the moon and say, can you imagine, people have walked up there, and that sort of feeling. He was fascinated by all things space, by all things NASA. And he would often say, do you know, there must be nothing better in the world than to work for NASA, whenever he saw a rocket launch or anything like that. So I kind of grew up with that idea. And then my mom was just very driven and very, quietly determined that she may not herself have wanted to walk on the moon, but she was damn sure I was going to have every opportunity I needed if I wanted to. And so, I think from both of them, my mom was just, you can do this. Even when I doubted myself, there was once where I said, I don't think I'm going to pass my exams. I think I should drop out. And she said, well, why don't you just go and take them anyway? Because you studied for them now. And then we'll have the information and we can make a decision after that. And I did pass them. So it was, good old mum. But that sort of nurturing background with my dad's fascination of all things space.
That's great. I love that. That's a very good combo and a real insight into not just how you've got to where you've got today, but just from hearing your enthusiasm, we can sort of totally understand why you are where you are today. And yes, on behalf of all UK space fans, I think we can all say thank you for that. Rich, do you have a final word for our Dr. Fox? Let's face it, Dr. Fox, it feels like you should have your own podcast with that name, Dr. Fox.
You could do a joint pod, Dr. Z and Dr. Fox.
Dr. Z and Dr.
We
Fox.
We could, yes. Yeah,
it's just so good.
I mean, I guess the final one really is, do you sense there's a buzz about space right now? I mean, I know with Artemis, but everything else. I mean, I'm just looking at the papers in the UK. I would say there is not a day where there isn't a story about space in some form. And I would say that 95% of those are positive stories for yes. What's going on.
Yeah, I think there really is a big buzz. Part of it is just with much more commercial space opening up access to space, you know, looking at the number of launches that we have, looking at just the technology and the way it's been really pushed forward in an incredibly aggressive way to really move us to where we need to be, selecting astronauts to go back to the moon. I mean, I was there when they actually went out, and I was there when they announced the astronauts, and yeah, I was doing the tears and the everything else, you know, because it's just so inspirational to see this. And even, you know, NASA is an amazing place to work, just because I think everybody does have this sort of shared purpose and this shared goal, and you are doing the impossible. You know, the impossible today is done tomorrow, and that kind of thing. The previous administrator, Jim Bridenstine, told a lovely story about being at Kennedy Space Center, and he was walking around, and Jim would often stop people and chat and just ask them what they did, you know, and he stopped this guy and he said, "What do you do?" And he said, "I am working to put the next people on the moon, sir." And he said, "Oh, that's great. What do you do?" And he said, "I'm a custodian." But that was the amount of passion he felt, that everything he did was moving us forward to be able to do these amazing things. And I think everybody in the agency feels like that. And it's just there is a buzz. There is a buzz at NASA. There's like a new energy at NASA. And I love to see it just rippling through everybody. And as you say, it's mostly really happy news. It's hopeful. It gives people hope that we can do these amazing things. So yes, I do.
Dr. Nicola Fox, NASA's new head of science, or in NASA speak, Associate Administrator for NASA's Science Mission Directorate. And she was, yes, ludicrous. She was, as you can hear, lovely. And what a brilliant science communicator. And of course, boffin.
Yes, I love the fact that she was going to embrace that word, particularly what happened while we were on holiday, wasn't it? We've been in Greece since our last... In Greece. Egypt. I knew it's a country. I knew it was warm. I was thinking Egypt. It came out Greece.
So you thought the whole time we were in Greece?
Yes. I wonder why those really odd sort of pyramid structures just thought, that's not Delphi. But and while we were there, there was in the UK, one of the newspapers, Daily Star, had this sort of campaign, and they contacted us because somebody, was it a scientist?
The Institute of Physics, which has form on this. So the Institute of Physics, the first time they tried this was 20 years ago, a campaign against the term boffin.
Yes.
Which, you know, as you all know, listening to the Space Boffins podcast, is a sort of slang term for scientists, but it's a very British sort of term for scientists. And they then very recently put out another report that says the term boffin is old-fashioned and we should get rid of it. So the Daily Star newspaper contacted us, one of Britain's finest tabloid newspapers, and so we gave a couple of quotes. And there is a brilliant picture of Sue in the Daily Star, which is because the picture of Sue, and it says in big letters underneath, nerd.
Yeah, and it's like, I'm an out-and-out nerd. What I liked about it was the fact that it's now my profile on Twitter, actually, that picture, because the sort of font and the colours they used, it was sort of, I think it was yellow outlined with red or something like that. It made it look like a sort of Batman style kapow or wham, or so it looked very cartoony. It was just utterly ridiculous. So yeah, we've
so we've both been quoted in
the
Daily Star.
We've both been quoted. I think we can just stop.
Let's retire now.
Yeah, that's it. But it's funny, isn't it? Because I know Americans, when we first started the podcast, which was 2011, American listeners said, "What does boffin mean? What, you know, is that, why are you using this word boffin?" But it was well known here, and our theory at the time was, you know, having worked in a newsroom at the BBC, one of the things that always used to happen to me was that people would just say, editors would just say, "Oh, I need a story," and it didn't matter whether it was, you know, on botany or it was a space story, it was physics or it's chemistry. They just said, "Can you get me a boffin?" And at first it used to irritate the hell out of me. And then, a bit like the word geek or nerd, you know, actually it was before we set up Boffin Media as well, we just thought, let's just embrace this. You know, why is it always seen in some cases as a negative thing? And just see it as good. And yeah, and the words geek have been transformed. It's like, who cares? It's geek chic, you know. And nerd is cool. Well, obviously in our circles it is. Something. And I think boffin's the same.
Yeah.
Embrace it. If you're smart, you know something about a subject, you don't have to have a degree in it, but you're a boffin.
And as I told the Daily Star, there's something brilliantly British about being a boffin.
It is indeed. Yeah. It's, I mean, if no, you're American it's, and you want to be a boffin, you can.
So we're out and proud.
We
as
are.
As boffins.
Absolutely.
Anyway, back to Dr. Nicola Fox.
Yeah. Oh, I love to say, fabulous that she's called herself a boffin. She mentioned two eclipses, which is great, because we are hopefully going to be at the annular eclipse, which is October the 14th. I think we're going for New Mexico, aren't we? Or hopefully to get there, because that will be
not
good
Greece.
Weather. Not Greece or Egypt even.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we're also going to try and go to the one next year, which is the total solar eclipse, also in the US, which goes right across the other side of the States on the East Coast. And that actually goes over where Wally Funk lives in Dallas, Texas. So I'm hoping to be there with Wally for that one. But
that's in, what, April 2024?
April the 8th. Yeah. The annular eclipse is October the 14th. And I saw on Twitter that quite a few people that we follow, the Space Boffins follow, Tim Peake, in fact. Tim Peake had gone to the recent solar eclipse in Exmouth, Western Australia.
Yeah, because it was because we're in a sort of very quite a small area. You had to be in a very specific point, didn't you?
To
have a good chance of seeing
it. That's determination. But I was quite impressed with the people who'd made their way there. But, you know, people know who've been to an eclipse before that it is unforgettable. And if you ever get the chance, do. But more recently, you've probably seen within the UK, well, actually not just within the UK, there have been some amazing aurora opportunities. I subscribed to the Aurora Watch app ever since we were in Finland, because obviously your chances of seeing the auroras in Finland
you don't really
are pretty
need the
good.
App in,
that's
you know,
true.
App,
just look out the window.
Finland's in winter if it's
yeah,
clear.
It's fabulous.
Yeah,
but you definitely
chance.
Need it in the UK. And we were with friends in the pub, and my phone flashed up and it said aurora. And it wasn't just our friends, it was you as well, looked at me as if to say, what are you doing? Because I got all excited and said, oh my goodness, it's red, and it's for the whole of the UK. Now, that hardly ever happens, that an aurora...
While the rain splashed against the pub windows.
That is the downside of it. But I have seen, you know, I saw some photos on Twitter of people in Scotland and people in, you know, near Stonehenge, and actually some great ones from like Kansas as well. People saying, oh my goodness, this is wonderful. And people from quite far south, people in the Ukraine as well. And the colours, the pinks and the greens and the reds, all above the clouds above our heads, sadly. But obviously the sun's going through some activity. So, yeah, get onto those apps, because it's great to get get a notification and let you know. And you can always set your alarm, which is what, as you know, I always do at like
3 o'clock
three
in the
morning to watch a meteor shower. That never happens.
Why do all astronomy events take place at 3 o'clock in the morning?
Well, I think it's more the UK, isn't it, the weather? But yeah, never mind, never mind. And we must say thank you to Thomas, by the way, for because it was Thomas who put us in touch with Nicola Fox immediately by email and said some really nice things about us and said you two should get together. But we love you, Thomas. This is Space Boffins. We're in partnership with the Naked Scientists.
Get in touch on Facebook or Twitter. We have no blue tick. There aren't any blue ticks anymore. Nor gold ticks.
No, there are.
No, they're gold now, aren't they?
Are they?
Yeah, gone gold.
But I thought people who refused to pay for blue ticks have now suddenly found they've got
blue ticks. Oh, they've got blue ticks. Oh, well, that's disappointing.
But Beyonce hasn't got a blue tick.
No, exactly.
Well, she might have one. By the time this goes up, she may well have one.
Oh, I was quite proud that, like Beyonce, we didn't have a blue tick. Anyway, it is us at Space Boffins. It's also a vast archive of 12 years' worth of Space Boffins on the Naked Scientists website, including a great interview last month with one of the senior scientists on the JUICE mission, now on its way to Jupiter, Michelle Doherty. I mean, two big launches in the last month. The JUICE mission, which went off 24 hours late, but it went off all perfect. That was astonishing that it's going all the way to Jupiter, pinging around the solar system with a 1 second launch window. Absolutely astonishing. And then with a rather longer launch window, Starship kind of drag itself off the launch pad with those 33 engines. I just thought that is extraordinary.
It felt very
technology.
Slow. I mean, often when you see rockets launch, whether live or on TV or your laptop or whatever, or in person, it does seem incredibly slow. But that one just seemed like it was on slow mo, didn't it?
When you've launched, look at the Apollo, that amazing Apollo 11 film, how slowly the Saturn V rockets, similarly. Yeah. I think it's only when you have the solid rocket boosters on them, which are just like lighting fireworks, that they do go off a lot faster. Mm-hmm. But actually, even the Ariane 5 with the JUICE mission, it's pretty slow to start with as it gets that momentum up. But yeah, the Starship did seem very, very slow. Mm-hmm. And I think it's fair to call it a success. Yes. You know, it was just the separation didn't work, and then they really had to destroy it because it was out of control. But that is going to be phenomenal.
And I like what you did with the opening theme tune there. Little 10-9-8 thing. As you know, I always get a little bit, you've changed it. Why? 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 Leave it. But I did, actually
like that.
You're
going to have to change it again
next month.
We can't probably leave. Well, maybe we could leave that in a few months.
You might as well.
But anyway, I think Starship's astonishing. I hope it all works because it's going to be the lander, at least the upper stage, the lander for Artemis 3. To the moon. And what's really interesting about that, I wrote a feature on this recently, and NASA are not giving much away on this because they clearly haven't finished negotiations. That Starship is capable of holding 100 people. Now, I'm not suggesting NASA are going to land 100 people on the moon, but you could fit an awful lot of stuff in that lander potentially. Could have a nice habitation in that lander potentially. So there's all sorts of things NASA could
have
do with that.
Ensuite bathroom.
Exactly, you could. You could actually go back to the...
Or like Skylab, you
yes,
could
exactly,
have a shower.
Yes, exactly, the worst space invention ever. You could do quite a lot with that. It's got huge potential. So I think the upper stage, the bottom stage, the lower stage with those engines all firing together, no one's attempted that since the Soviet Union with their moon rockets, which didn't work. To have that all coordinating together is astonishing technology. But then the upper stage too, just the capacity of that, whether you're launching satellites or carrying people, is astonishing. So, yeah, let's hope it all comes together.
And also it's nice to see again the sort of boundaries of what we can do within space on Earth being pushed and stretched. And tested, because it's been stationary for a very long time. And then the advances were made primarily in certain areas, particularly satellites. And it's just wonderful to have something that's refreshingly different.
Yeah, no, it's great. Well, I hope it all all succeeds and Elon Musk doesn't lose too much money on Twitter in the meantime.
Yes, that's it. We'll keep away from that, shall we? Mm. In the meantime, in November, you may recall, ESA announced its new Astronaut Corp. Well, this month, those lucky men and women began training. One of those new recruits is Pablo Alvarez from Spain, who has quite a connection with the UK, as he's worked here for several years with Airbus, including on the ExoMars rover. Well, we met for a chat in Germany recently at a showing of three European service modules for the Artemis mission. That's so hard to say, isn't it? Artemis missions at Airbus. And it's an understatement to say that he had quite a grin on his face at the thought of what lies ahead.
I am extremely happy that I've given this opportunity the chance to become an astronaut, and I'll make the most of every minute.
And what's really nice is that we're in Airbus in Bremen, and you've worked at Airbus in Stevenage, where I've been a lot in the Mars Yard there and interviewing scientists there. You know, how does it feel knowing that your experience as an engineer is now you're going to see things the other side of the fence, effectively?
It feels great, and I think it also gives me the security and the safety that everything is that is done at Airbus at an engineering level is really at it excels. It's a top level technology, and
you have that inside view.
Yes. And because we really take care of every little detail. So you know, I'm ready to jump in the spacecraft at any moment if I had the chance.
Yeah, that's nice, isn't it? It does give you that reassurance. Was it a tough process to get to this stage?
It was very tough. It was very long. It lasted for over 18 months, and it had several stages, many good candidates, excellent, and many of them were left behind for different reasons, but yes, very, very hard. The selection process itself was the hardest bit. You know, the waiting after every stage to get an answer, either positive or negative, whilst still trying to prepare for the next one, it's very, very hard. Like always, you know, all these questions. How did you, like, did I do good enough? Why did I say that? Oh, I should have answered this other thing. Or why, you know, I should have prepared this better. And this was probably the hardest, waiting for a good answer from ESA.
And what were you doing when you found out that you'd passed?
I was working. Fortunately, I was working from home that day. So I could scream of happiness freely. I was alone at home, and luckily also because the director general told us not to tell anyone, and we had to keep the secret for 12 days.
And that would have been harder if you'd been in work, because yes, they probably would have heard you go, yes!
Yes, everyone would have known. But I went, yes, I screamed, and then I did, okay, I cannot celebrate it with anyone, because what do I do? So I went back to work.
So where are you working for Airbus at the moment, and what are you working on?
So at the moment I was working in Madrid as a project manager for aircraft. So I had moved out of space division. But before that, I used to work as a mechanical architect for the ExoMars rover, Rosalind Franklin and Stephen H. A great time, 3.5 years over there. And before, I used to work in Bristol, also as a structural engineer for several aircraft. So I've been in England for quite a while.
And obviously got an amazingly exciting phase ahead. At the same time, it's like a marathon. It's a long haul. How do you mentally prepare yourself for something like that, which compared to the waiting in the selection process could be 10 times worse, because you could fly to the ISS in a couple of years, it could be 7 years.
Yes, I'm glad you make that comparison, because I was doing it myself the other day, and so far the selection process has been only like signing up for that marathon, and now I have to start running it, and it will be long. I think the selection teaches you how to be patient and flexible, and to learn that, you know, especially nowadays we are used to get everything immediately. It doesn't work with the space. It can be in 4 years from now, it can be in 7 years or 10 years, or I don't know, maybe I will never get an opportunity. It's also a possibility, but anyways, I'm ready to commit myself to make the best and do the best training I can.
And how do you feel about the fact that humanity is returning to the moon? You know, something that will have happened before you were born.
I think it's great that we are finally going back and we are ready to develop all the science and technology there in the moon to actually try to go even farther. When we explore the Antarctica for the first time, Scott and Asmussen, they had their race, like similar to the one with the United States and Soviet Union, and we didn't come back to the Antarctica until 50 years later. Similar story with the moon. I think that now we are more technologically advanced and we are ready to actually have a permanent presence in the moon and see what scientific discoveries it brings us back to the Earth.
And have you spent much time with your fellow trainees yet?
We were actually locked for 4 days near Paris before the announcement, so I had the chance to meet all of them there. But I have to say that at least half of them I knew before, because during the selection process, of course, we were all in contact. We had several WhatsApp groups in which we, you know, shared
information,
discussions. How do you know anything? Have you heard anything? How do you do here? And so it was quite interesting. And The good thing about this selection process is that it allowed me to know so many amazing individuals that I'm still in touch with. And of course, the 17 that were selected at the end, I think we are quite close already, and we have regular meetings to set everything up.
Going to the moon is very different to being on the ISS. It's potentially longer term in the future. Would you take that opportunity?
Of course, and it's still a long way. I need to start my training. I need to be assigned to an ISS mission before even being on the queue to the missions to Mars. To the moon, sorry.
Hold on there.
Sorry. But yes, of course, it will be a dream come true to have this opportunity.
Well, best of luck, and we'll be looking forward to following your progress with interest.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Astronaut trainee Pablo Alvarez. Now, you mentioned, we mentioned at the top of the podcast that he could be one of those people that go to the moon, and we've just heard how he's, you know, up and ready, but obviously he's got his ISS training to and a placement to happen first. It must be very exciting for all those astronauts who are actually you know, doing their training right now as we speak. I know it's too early to sort of put money on sort of who do you think will go, but I know you're very keen on the UK's para-astronaut, aren't you?
Yeah, but I also think, well, if I'm going to put money on who the first European astronaut to set foot on the moon will be, my money is on Matthias Meira, because he is heading up the moon simulation facility at the European Astronaut Centre in Cologne. So he is going to know the most about walking around on the moon. He's a scientist as well, and he's due more missions. So that's who my money would be on.
Ah, right. And I reckon his close competition then could be the person we're about to hear next.
It depends whether they jump a generation or not, doesn't
well,
it?
Well, yeah, more experienced. And we're talking about German astronaut Alexander Gerst. Yeah, huge experience. Pretty much a year he spent in space, from being part of the Blue Dot mission in 2014, the Horizons mission 2017, and then a third mission a year later, when he was only the second European astronaut to be given command of the space station. So Alex not only has his eyes on another mission, he's going to be helping those new recruits?
So I'm going to still be an active astronaut in the European Astronaut Corps, but at the same time, in between missions, what we astronauts typically do is we use our experience that we gained in space to help out other programs or to help out colleagues. Like in my case, I'm going to be the lead of the astronaut operations team at the European Astronaut Center, and that means I'm going to work with our new colleagues, the new astronauts that will join ESA at the beginning of April to start basic training, and I will make sure they have everything that they need to be successful in basic training. At the same time, my team is responsible for the crew support of the astronauts flying to the space station. We have Andreas Mogensen flying to the space station this year with Crew 7, so we're going to take care of his family and help him to have a successful mission. And also in my team, there are the Eurocoms. Those are the communicators between the ground station and the International Space Station, in this case the Columbus module, and their communicator team is also in my group, so I'm going to make sure that they have all they need for doing their really interesting but also tough job.
That's quite a wide brief, really. In terms of your experience on the International Space Station, what would you say is the gift of advice you can pass on to the new recruits that you learnt, not necessarily in the theory and being on the ground, but actually being in space?
One thing that surprised me on all my missions is that I ended up being able to do much more than I thought I would. That is something I already learned when working in Antarctica five times, that I always go out there having a concern, maybe I'm not able to do this or maybe I'm not able to do that because it's beyond my boundaries. And then in the end, it always turns out that it's actually amazingly easy to do that job. And I found that in working in space too. It's not, I wouldn't say it's completely easy all the time, but it's something that was way easier than I anticipated. And that's really the message that I want to give to the new recruits, is that, hey, I'm sure that you guys can do this, that they're are going to be successful, I'm very sure, and to encourage them and to make sure that they focus on the right things, right? That they don't have to be afraid of this, what lies ahead of them, but actually look forward in curiosity. And I can see this in them, so there's not much work for me to do. Really, I'm there. I see my role as being there to help them get what they need to do their job properly.
You're a geophysicist,
yeah.
So you must have very specific reasons why you're interested in returning to the moon and what we can learn from the moon.
Well, I wouldn't say it's based on my own interest. I think in general it's very important that we go there. The moon is an open history book, right? You can find rocks there that are older than 4 billion years. Those rocks just don't exist anymore on Earth in that way, and we can just read them on the moon, whereas on the Earth they're gone. And so from the moon we can read about our early history. The moon came to existence probably out of Earth. We really don't even know that yet completely. That's another reason. But also the moon allows us to look into the future. If we go there and study the distribution of meteorite impact craters there, we can actually get a much better statistic on how likely it is that the moon gets hit and also Earth gets hit by one in the future. That's something that's a little bit of a blind eye that we have, and that's something we need to work on in order to prevent maybe one hitting later by preparing for it in a better way. One part of it is knowing what the chances are and you know how to protect our Earth and the cities from that. And in general, it's a little bit like discovering Antarctica as an undiscovered continent. The moon is just 3 to 5 days of travel away. That's much closer than Antarctica was 100 years ago, when going there was dangerous and expensive, and people asked, why do we need to go to this empty continent? And now we know why. There's lots of research stations there in Antarctica. We literally discovered the ozone hole there. It's a climate archive, and the same will happen to the moon. In 50 to 100 years from now, there will be many research stations there, and I'm very sure someone at that stage will talk about why it was so important to go there by having discovered something that you and I today cannot even imagine.
I was surprised to learn today that you're involved with the design relating to Gateway.
Yes, that's my current job. It's actually very, very interesting because it allows me to use my experience that I gained from pretty much 1 year living in space, helping the designers of the new modules to, say, design a galley or a sleep station for the crew, basically the crew systems in general that exist in IHAB, the windows, the cargo systems in the Esprit module. Those are all things that can benefit from, of course, the experience from the engineers building them, but also from an astronaut having lived on the space station. So in synergy, we work together, and that's very great. I mean, I love that job because every day we come up with new solutions. That synergy between them and us, and actually is a very, very, well, a good way of working, because I learned a lot about their way of doing, and I think the outcome is going to be interesting. So I think the IHAB will be benefiting from the design of the International Space Station, but will be even better.
Yeah. And in terms of us returning to the moon, you were at the launch of Artemis 1.
Yes, correct. I was lucky enough to witness Artemis 1 launch into space. That was amazing to see. It took a few attempts, and I was lucky enough to be there at the final attempt when it went on 16th of November. The most powerful rocket that's ever been launched to space, and that was a thing to see, and not only to see, but more actually to feel.
And would you like to be one of those astronauts that get the opportunity to fly on an Artemis mission?
Yeah, I think you could ask any one of my colleagues or myself. We would all say yes to that question. Of course, we would love to fly. That's our job. And as astronauts, of course, we chose that profession because we are fascinated by space. And that's one of the ultimate missions that you could fly on.
So there isn't going to be any tension then between you when you're working with the new recruits and the fact that you think, that could be my competition.
No, it's actually really nice to work with the new team of astronauts to hand over some of the experience to them. They will most likely fly to ISS to gain experience there. They have a lot of time with missions there, and at the same time, the experienced astronauts will do some of the Artemis missions. So it's going to be a busy time for the European Astronaut Corps, and so no competition there.
ESA astronaut Alexander Gerst. Now, I've got some fun facts for you about Alexander.
How fun are they?
Really fun. I got them from the ESA website, so I'm going to share them with you. These are the ones that stuck out to me.
Okay.
When he was at school, he was a volunteer firefighter, a Boy Scout leader, and a lifeguard. And he developed a new volcano monitoring technique when he was doing his master's. And as a geophysicist, he installed scientific instruments in Antarctica. Now, if that's not cool, you know when they always say on your CV, have something, you know, that's a little surprising. You don't want it to be all work, work, work. It's got to be something different. You need something. I just think firefighter.
Yes, but
you know,
they're
with
always
Antarctica.
Such overachievers, aren't they?
I know, but that's just great. That's
I mean,
great.
You know, if I'm going to name a quirky thing on my CV, it would obviously be that I was once in a Barry Manilow backing choir.
Oh, of course. I thought you were going to say you played the clarinet in a band. But no, you're right. Barry Manilow.
Barry Manilow. Can't even say it. Barry Manilow backing choir. Yeah.
Mine.
I was 14, but
I'm trying to think.
I mean, real Barry Manilow. It wasn't like a tribute Barry Manilow. It was the real Barry Manilow.
Well, I can
Royal Philharmonic.
I can say, you know, I've driven an exact replica of the Apollo lunar module with Gene Cernan outside the Science Museum in London. That's not bad. I'm trying to think if I've got any other quirky. As like you, being a journalist, I have met some
interesting
people.
It's just all secondhand,
isn't
it? It's secondhand experiences.
It's just like, oh, yeah, you need something really, really cool. I'll think about it. See if I can think about it by this time.
next month.
Next month.
That's the Space Boffins podcast for April 2023, just about. We'll be back next month. In the meantime, do get in touch. Social media, email. We're podcast@spaceboffins.com. And if you want to hear more from us, we were guests in a recent Space and Things podcast.
Yeah, that's so nice,
the
Emily
excellent Space and
Dave,
Things podcast.
It's
really somewhat controversial on Twitter.
Well, not controversial, one person.
Yeah.
Said
said some things.
Yeah.
Anyway, have a listen. Make a judgment for yourself.
Yeah, it's really good and they're great.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening.